Make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with verses 14 and 15. Draw water for yourself, water for the siege. In other words, make all the internal preparations and external preparations you're going to make, all that you want to make, and getting into the idea of fortifying the city, or not just that particular city. That would be what's in view here with the second feminine singular suffix. Draw waters for yourself and strengthen your fortifications would look primarily first at Nineveh, again because of the second feminine singular suffix, the city itself, to build up the walls, and that is seen in those imperatives that follow, what they would have to do in order to fulfill this, go into the clay, tread the mortar, take hold of the brick mold. There, however, in spite of all this effort that one might expend in order to prepare for this, fire will eat you. Fire will consume you. The sword will cut you down. It will consume you, again, the reference here being the sword, as the locust does. Now, multiply yourself like the creeping locust. Multiply yourself like the swarming locust. And we are dealing with that issue, having looked at some things about locusts. Again, they look much more like our grasshoppers. That's, you know, if you go online and look for a picture of a locust, you'll see that they actually very much similar to a grasshopper. 42 is where we're ready to begin. Nahum now uses the locust simile to make a different point that is applied to the Ninevites themselves and not to the invading army. The first locust reference gets into the military capabilities of the invading army killing off the Ninevites. Here he moves into a challenge to the Ninevites to fortify their defenses and also to strengthen their ability to reproduce faster is the idea of it. Not that you can do that, but again, this is a taunt, and so we recognize they're not going to actually probably fulfill much of this. So having introduced the concept of the locust, point 43, Nahum now turns to emphasize one of the many or one of the great characteristics of this creature. It has an amazing ability to reproduce. 44, twice he uses the hithpile imperative of the verb kaved. Again, the first issue, it could be either an infinitive absolute, but it is not unusual for an infinitive absolute to be used in a string of imperatives, which essentially just gives it imperatival force. So twice he uses the imperative of the verb kaved to make oneself heavy or weighty, or in this case, numerous, for emphasis. 45, while there is some question about the parsing of the first verb, it is clear that it is not the same form as the second usage. So 46, some understand the first imperative to be an infinitive absolute, while others parse it as a masculine imperative. And so that gets into the question, if it's not an infinitive absolute, why, you know, all these imperatives are feminines? Why all of a sudden would he shift to a masculine? They're all addressed to a feminine audience, again, because of the city, the Hebrew term for city is feminine. 47, the New English Translation notes indicate that the infinitive absolute is used to convey a sense of urgency. And Gesenius, in his Hebrew grammar, sees the verb as a masculine imperative, which he says serves to express the totality of the nation. And clearly, as we got into the idea there of the fortified cities, not only Nineveh's fortifications, but other fortified cities, and the land being open, what starts out directed solely at Nineveh expands as we go through the prophecy to take in the other parts of the empire. In 48, in either case, no matter how many merchants, officials, and military personnel Nineveh may amass, they will not prove helpful in the end, as we will see in the following verses. So now, verse 16, you have increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. You got the Hifil perfect to increase. This particular stem, Rabah, R-A-B-H-A-H, is not causative in this case. It just means to make numerous, to cause to be numerous. And then you have the cal active participle here, masculine plural, with the second feminine singular suffix, which functions as a substantive of the verb ra-cal.
R-A-K-H-A-L.
That word literally, the verb means to move around, is the literal sense of it. And so it comes to mean one who traffics or trades in things. And so they've just translated it because they were, you know, the merchants would move from place to place. You have increased your traders more than, is actually from, the preposition men, from the stars, or more than the stars of heaven. Kokav is the term for stars.
K-O-K-H-A-V-H.
Kokav, the stars of, and it's a construct, the heavens, Shemaid. The creeping locust strips and flies away. Yelek, again, the nine times it's used, that locust, again, deals with all of the stages of growth. Then you've got the Cal Perfect, which is, again, they've translated it like it's a present tense. But again, this is a prophetic perfect. So it's viewed as, again, completed action of this verb of Pashat. P-A-S-H-A-T. That word means to strip off something. to take something off yourself. So in this case, to strip off isn't looking at the action of the locust as it strips the land of vegetation. It's looking at the action of the locust as it sheds its skin, to strip off the skin. So the locust, we could even translate it here in this context by the word molts. The locust molts and flies away. A wow consecutive plus the cal imperfect of oof.
The word oph, O-P-H, is the Hebrew term for birds.
Oof is the verb to fly, or to fly around. Your guardsmen are like the swarming locust. Your guardsmen here is menzar, the masculine plural noun construct. It's only used one time, so they have suggested that this is an Assyrian loanword, M-I-N-Z-A-R, because it's related to an Assyrian term. For an attendant or guard in the royal court. So your guardsmen, is the way they've translated it here, are like the swarming locust. Inseparable preposition, kop plus the definite article plus now uses a different word, arbah.
A-R-B-H-E-H.
Arbah, or that should be B-B, there's no H there, B-B-E-H. And this is a general term for a locust or grasshopper. Again, why he changes terms here, we don't really know. Probably has to do with his poetic thought that he uses a different term here. Your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers. Like the grasshopper, literally. Your marshals is actually now the masculine plural noun construct of Tiphsar,
T-I-P-H-S-A-R.
That's an Assyrian term that means a scribe or a marshal. The term designated military officials who recorded the names of recruits and the military activities of Assyrian kings. It looks like it comes from the root safar is there, which means to write or to record something. And so it looks like the term is actually related to the Hebrew term for a scribe or a court reporter, not in a legal sense court reporter, but a court of the king, one who kept the official records. So your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers. Again, you've got the inseparable preposition kop plus the masculine singular noun here of gov.
G-O-V-H.
That term is only used in this verse, and it means a locust. He's actually uses now, as we will see, three different terms for locust in here. Now, what the significance exactly is of each term, that's up for grabs. Some of them, it's very difficult to know if he meant to make a distinction or if he just used general terms to describe locust. Some of them appear to be locusts at a specific stage of growth, but the others don't. And then so what you've got here is you've got the masculine singular noun construct coupled with that same word, gove, in the masculine plural noun. So you would translate it like locust and locusts. So the idea is a swarm of locusts, a great number of locusts. So your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers settling down. You got the definite article plus the calactic participle again, which acts here. The one settling down, literally, of Cana.
C-H-A-N-A-H.
And that word means to settle down or to camp somewhere. They are settling down in the stone walls. Preposition bait, the inseparable preposition here, plus the word Gedera.
G-E-D, what do we got here? D-H-E-R-A-H.
Gedera. That word means a shelter or wall. It can mean, you know, like the wall of a house, or just a wall that's built up, but made out of stone. On a cold day. Again, the inseparable preposition bait, plus the masculine singular noun construct, on a day of cold, literally. So they just translated here for smoother English. A cold day is kara, the feminine singular noun means cold. The sun rises and they flee. The common singular noun shemesh for sun. The sun rises is a cal perfect here. Now, and it's translated here in a present tense because this denotes kind of habitual normal action. This is a truth that they understand about locusts. That when a cold snap hits, they go more into a dormant stage and they settle down and they can remain motionless for quite some time. And then but as the sun rises, their metabolism increases and they become far more active. So the sun rises or comes up is Zarach,
Z-A-R-A-C-H.
And that means to rise or come up. And they flee. The word here is Gadad.
G-A-D-H-A-D-H.
Now that word means it's a poal, which is just a different stem that's very similar to the pual. To move around or away from something. To flee. So that's how they've translated it. They flee. And the place where they are is not known. It is not known, negative low here, plus the nifal perfect
of yada, the verb to know or to figure out. It can't be ascertained.
Again, the word means to figure something out, to recognize it, to understand. It is not known. And then you've got the masculine singular noun construct with the third masculine singular suffix of makom.
And that word means the physical place.
And that word is translated by the word place. Again, the place where something is or ought to be. And then that's followed up with the interrogative particle A, with the third masculine plural suffix, and which really kind of is a question, where are they? And so they just translate it where they are because you've got this verb of knowing that precedes this, and it is not understood or known of where they are. Okay, point one here now. Nahum continues his description of things that are going to change when word of the coming invasion reaches the inhabitants of Nineveh. And certainly, I would think, we don't know how much, because again, there's nothing left of the place, so we can't really say. How much advance warning did they have on this? They would have had to have known before the actual siege began. A word would have been brought to them that there were invading armies coming. But how long did they know ahead of time? Well, we don't know. But some things are certainly going to change. Two, in verse 14, Nahum focused on the reality that the leadership will begin making the necessary preparations for the coming attack. Three, he turns to the commerce of Nineveh, which was known to be significant. We have already been informed that Nineveh had become the repository of a great deal of wealth, which resulted from the plunder of others. We saw that in chapter 2, verse 8 and 9, under the pool of water metaphor, though Nineveh was like a pool of water throughout her days. This was the place where things collected. And what collected was a great spoil, of course, the booty that they had taken from these other nations. And now they are fleeing, but no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. For there is no limit to the treasure, wealth from every kind of desirable object. And we saw it in 3:1, her prey or her pillage, what she has pillaged, never departs. That there is, again, a significant amount of wealth that has been pouring into this city. For Assyria enjoyed the prosperity that came from such conquests, enjoying a prosperous economy, which became home to a huge number of businessmen. Again, we're talking about a city that's probably, at the time of Jonah, in excess of 500,000. And they have not had any real true military setbacks or anything since then. So no doubt the city was even larger by this time, 100 years later. Not larger in the sense that they changed the walls, but I mean more populous. So 5, historians have recognized that as major cities, such as the Assyrian capital, saw significant increases in population, the areas around these cities, that should be could not, simply rely upon agriculture to support the populace. This is, as we know, one of the problems you get into with population growth is the ability or inability to find sufficient food to feed the people. And that becomes a problem. And so they have to figure out other ways to make money. So this necessitated, 6, trade for grain and other foodstuffs, or conquest involving tribute. Therefore, the Assyrians were part of a growing enterprise, which is often established and maintained through client states. And again, they would, you know, receive tribute and all of that, and that allowed them to purchase pretty much whatever they needed. 7, Nahum uses a bit of hyperbole to indicate the extent to which the city had become a dominant force in the Middle East. And that's in, you know, you've increased your traders more than the stars of heaven. Not really. They weren't that numerous. The stars of heaven, again, is a figure for an innumerable number. So, 8, this is designed to emphasize the tremendous numbers of merchants that plied their trades in and around the Assyrian capital. 9, Olmsted suggests that the Assyrians did not particularly care for trading as an industry, and the commerce was largely carried on through subject nations. 10, he goes on to acknowledge that the Assyrian armies of conquest were soon followed by traders' caravans. Assyrian might, now this is a good thing about having a military force that is of some substance, because the fact is, the reality is, the stronger the military in that place, the greater the safety was there, and they kept the peace. And that worked out very well for those involved in business. And that's one of the, again, that's one of the regular functions of a good military and of a good government. It's designed to provide an environment in which the citizens can grow and prosper. And if the army can guarantee you, you know, peace and security, well, that makes it all the easier. And that's exactly what they did. So Assyrian might ensured a peaceful environment, which encouraged business. So 11, in the midst of this economic growth, Nahum indicates that the merchants involved in this were more than the stars of heaven, which is an idiom, again, for an innumerable number. You see that, for instance, in the pact with Abraham. I will multiply you more than the stars of the heaven and more than the sand on the seashore. Who's going to go out and count those things? Well, we do know that the stars of heaven are finite, and truly the sand is finite. But who's, you know, you want to go out and count it? I don't think so. We know they're finite numbers, but again, they're very, very large numbers. So 12, there is some minor debate as to the form of the first verb, rava, to increase or make numerous, which some want to amend, the Biblia Hebraica editors, want to amend to an imperative based on the imperatives found in the previous verse. And 13, however, there is no textual reason to change it from the Hifil perfect, which is designed to indicate the reality that Assyrian merchants had already become quite numerous. 14, although there is no discrete preposition here, Nahum once again employs a simile to compare the merchants of Nineveh with the locusts. 15, as the word of the coming invasion filtered into Nineveh, the businessmen would have no reason to remain. Thus, they would take their products and flee. And 16, unfortunately, this would leave the citizens without some of the provisions that would be necessary to survive a siege. And for this reason, point 17, Nahum compares these merchants to young locusts, which sheds its outer skin and begins to fly. And so one of the things you see, when you see this term, then and I've seen a number of interpreters, I don't know if they ever looked at the original language in the Hebrew to see what it was saying, but some of them had interpreted this phrase strips to refer to the actions of the locust as they denude a landscape of vegetation. But that's not what's in view here. It's, again, dealing with the molting process. So 18, although some have understood this figure to indicate the action of the locust stripping an area of vegetation, the figure is actually one of a change of circumstances. The verb 19, pashat, to strip off, does not refer to stripping something externally. It refers to the locust's emergence from the nymph stage, at which time it sheds the skin which holds its wings. So until that point, I mean, again, you've probably seen grasshoppers jump, and they can jump some distance. They can cover a lot of ground just simply by jumping. But at some point, they shed their skin, and the skin, the outer skin that kept them from flying, is shed off, and then they're able to fly. And so then they can travel even greater distances. So then it's able to fly, of course, without hindrance. 20, although the merchants have willingly spent their time in Nineveh when all things were favorable to them, a change is coming that will cause them to develop wings and fly away. 21, in that regard, these businessmen do not concern themselves with anything but their own well-being. What a shock. We can't expect that's the case, right? Of course, this is exactly what one would expect, I would think. That ultimately, if you're in business for yourself, you're only concerned about yourself at that level. So Nineveh is simply another place that has now become unsuitable for them. Again, as the word got here, people started leaving. Some of the people escaped simply because they got out early, and they didn't want to take the chance. Well, 22, now they not only have now the motivation, but they still have the ability to flee the region. 23, in verses 17 and 18, Nahum turns to the military personnel, the administrative personnel, and the political leadership, which are also likened to locusts. 24, the first term translated as guardsmen is the Hebrew term menazar, which is used only here in the Old Testament. It appears to be related to an Assyrian term that means guard. And so I think they've done as well as you can with it here. It gets to the military personnel that are designed to defend the city. So 25, this term is used to point out that those that one might reasonably expect to stand their posts will desert the city during the invasion. 26, the term mipsar, the New American Standard translates marshals, is used only twice in the Old Testament, and be related to the Hebrew term safar, which means to count or recount. Again, that in one stem it means to write, and in the other stem it means to count something or recount it, and it has the idea of recording stuff. So 27, the term is used to denote administrative military officials who recorded the names of recruits and the military activities of Assyrian kings. In 28, locusts tend to be quite active during the warmer parts of the day. However, when the temperature begins to drop, the locust will settle down in hedges, fences, walls, or even on plants, and remain practically motionless until the temperature begins to rise the next day. Now, some here, when they see that term on a cold day, some of them want to say, well, he's talking about winter. He's not talking about winter. He's not talking about a change of seasons here. He's talking about just the natural rise and fall of the temperature during the course of the day as you get towards evening, particularly in the desert climates where they live. Anybody that's ever been in the desert knows it can be exceedingly hot during the day, but the temperature rapidly falls in the evening. And at night, it can get down, to freezing even. And it'd be 100 degrees the next day because, again, there's no humidity to trap any moisture in the air and to trap any heat. And if there's no cloud cover, well, then you've got a real problem. So you get these, and they can be major temperature swings. Well, the locust, again, is usually active during the day, but at night settles down. And that's kind of what he's getting at here. As the temperature changes, they become dormant, essentially. And 29, these civil and military officials, whom Nahum is clearly disparaging, are likened to a swarm of locusts that have settled comfortably within Nineveh. 30, in the analogy, the civil and military leadership within Nineveh, like the traitors, have been in a somewhat of a dormant phase. However, as the heat of battle rises, they flee the scene like a swarm of locusts. And 31, as Patterson has observed, ancient sources record the flight of the Assyrian nobility with the advance of the combined enemy force against Nineveh. Now, not all the leadership fled, obviously. But the fact is, and there are incidences that, yes, they did. Some of them did. We do know from history, or certainly we have, what I found out from history is that the Assyrian king remained till the very end, but of course he died anyway. So 32, the Assyrian kings repeatedly boast that on hearing of the advance of the Assyrian monarch, the enemy king and his officials very often fled for their lives. Ashurbanipal stated that in my second campaign, I made straight for Egypt and Ethiopia. Tandamani heard of the advance of my army and that I was invading the territory of Egypt. He forsook Memphis and fled to Nee to save his life. And that was actually during the campaign that was alluded to earlier in chapter 3, in which he went to Thebes and conquered and sacked it. So that was out of that very campaign. Another quote from that same king said, Uman al-Dasi, king of Elam, heard of the entrance of my armies into the midst of Elam, forsook Madaktu, his royal city, and fled up into the mountains, literally to his mountain. Abua, who after Elam had risen in revolt, had fled to the city of Babalu, and had seated himself on the throne of Elam in the place of Uman al-Dasi. Heard that like one of my invasion, forsook Bubalu, the city that was his royal seat, and like a fish, betook himself to the depth of the distant waters. So they were, again, they were quite proud of the fact that they struck such fear into the hearts of people. But as we've seen throughout this book, all the things that they have done, all the things that they have sown, they are now going to reap, and reap in great measure. That is, again, the principle of the reaping and sowing law. You get what you give. 33, the last statement in verse 17 indicates that those that should have been in charge of saving the city have disappeared. They have vanished and no one has any idea where they went. However, point 34, what is obvious is that they cannot be found, since they have either been killed or have fled the scene in order to save their lives. Those who did got out, good, did, and left, smartly so. Those that didn't all died generally horrible deaths or were taken captive. And the city itself, of course, becomes a ghost town. Well, verse 18, now he turns to another metaphor. Your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Cal Perfect here, third person plural of Noom. And that word means exactly that, to go to sleep or to be asleep, six times, literally to slumber or sleep. Some here want to make this a figure for laziness. I don't think that's it. I think it's used to denote a lack of watchfulness or carelessness. They're neglectful of what they should be doing. And then the Cal active participle, he addresses the masculine plural noun masculine plural construct with the second masculine singular of ra'ah, and this verb means to shepherd a flock. And so the Cal active participle is one who shepherds, a shepherd. Those who are responsible to tend the flock in Assyria, those in positions of power and authority. And it's not unusual in the Old Testament for political leaders to be, royal leaders to be known as shepherds. And we'll see that. And some religious leaders were known by that term as well, but political leaders were. And then here for the first time, you get this address, a personal address. This is a note to the king of Assyria. And the Cal Perfect, again, indicates that they're already asleep. They're already being too careless. And then you got the word Melech, king.
O king, M-E-L-E-K.
King of Asher.
A-S-H-S-H-U-R.
Asher, and that, of course, and that's the Hebrew term for Assyria. So here, he's talking, and interestingly enough, too, and this should point out, the first thing that I thought was, well, why is he addressing the king of Assyria? This is primarily towards Nineveh. And the fact is, the king he's addressing here is the king that has moved, that managed to survive this, not the king that's in power at the time that Nineveh is conquered. This is the king of Assyria that established a new kingdom, not a new kingdom, but a new capital, rather, at Herod. And so this is the very last king of the Assyrian Empire. And here he's addressed to tell him, essentially, that as we get into this, that his people are all dead. That the vast majority of them are dead. And so his kingdom doesn't amount to much, as we're going to see. So your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are lying down. The Kal imperfect, third masculine plural of Shakan, S-H-A-K-H-A-N. That means to settle down or to dwell or to reside, hence to be unconcerned, to not be concerned or disturbed by things. And the masculine plural noun subject adjective here that functions as a subject of this is Adir.
A-D-D-I-Y-R.
That means mighty, stately, or majestic. So they've translated here nobles, which is fine. Your nobles have settled down or lying down. Your people are scattered on the mountains. The Nephal imperfect here of Push.
P-U-S-H.
Five terms. This word means literally to skip about or to charge along. It's passive, and the idea here is to be skipped. So scattered is a good way to translate it here. They are being charged along. It's the idea of the sheep being put out to the mountains. On the mountains. Your people is actually the word am, which is your people. And then upon the mountains.
Preposition al plus this word, har, which means exactly that, mountains.
And there is no one to regather them. The adverb, a while here, and, plus the adverb, ayin, there does not exist. And then, you only have two words here in the Hebrew that's translated by there is no one to regather them. You got the PL participle, masculine singular of kavats.
Q-A-V-H-A-T-S.
That word literally means to gather people into one place, to call an assembly together. So there is no one to gather them together. There is no relief for your breakdown. Again, adverb ayin, there does not exist. Then the feminine singular noun here,
keha, K-E-H-A-H.
That word means relief from wounds or healing. The word is not well attested. That's about the best. So they've translated by the word relief. The idea is there's no healing for your breakdown. Preposition, inseparable preposition lamed plus the masculine singular noun construct with the second masculine singular construct of
shever.
S-H-E-B-H-E-R. Now that word means a break or a breach. It's used of the ruin or destruction of a kingdom. So your wound, there is no relief for your breakdown. They've translated that word by breakdown. There's no healing from your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. The Nephal participle here, feminine singular, of kala.
C-H-A-L-A-H.
That word means literally, because it's a passive, being overcome by sickness, and they've translated that one by the term wound. I'm sorry. They haven't translated that. Your wound is overcome by sickness is literally what you have in the Hebrew. Because the word wound is the feminine singular noun of makah.
M-A-K-A-H.
And that word means literally it's a blow. It's, you know, like a punch. So it's used figuratively of a wound or a plague or an affliction. Or even sometimes it goes to the point of a defeat when dealing with a military sense, which is the idea here. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you. All of the ones hearing, literally. And the word of this, of course, is going to spread throughout the empire and to the other nations. That Nineveh has been captured. And Nineveh has been razed to the ground. The Assyrians are in disarray. They are ripe for the picking, we might say, using that fig metaphor that he used earlier. And so this just encourages Nineveh's enemies, and the Assyrian enemies. So all who hear about you, all those hearing, all of the ones hearing, literally, shamaz, the verb to hear, all the ones hearing about you is actually all the ones hearing the report or the rumor or the news is the masculine singular noun construct of shema.
S-H-E-M-A.
That comes again from the verb right above it for hearing. And this is this relates to what is heard. The news, the report, the rumor. We'll clap their hands. Again, they've translated it as an imperfect, but it's actually a perfect. The cal perfect third person plural of takah.
T-A-Q-A apostrophe.
They will clap their hands. That word means to clap or to utter a shout of applause. The palm of the hand, literally, feminine singular noun of calf, which denotes, they have another word for hand, K-A-P-H. But this emphasizes the palm of the hand, you know, what you would cup. And the way you clap, of course, is with your palm. So this is perfectly accurate. They will shout or applaud. They will clap the hand concerning you or about you. Over you is they've translated this in its more spatial sense, because of you. Preposition ale here. And the sense of it is on account of what has happened to you, the destruction that has come upon you. Because, or for here, you've got a conjunction key that introduces this question. For upon whom? Preposition ale again, plus the interrogative pronoun me. Me means who or whom. For upon whom has your evil not passed continually? Has not passed is the negative low plus the cal perfect third feminine singular of avar.
And that means, literally it means to pass over, or cross over in a figurative sense,
to pass by. It can be used of transgression. And essentially that's kind of the sense of it here. Who haven't you transgressed against? The implication being everybody has suffered under you. And then your evil, again, gets into the entire Assyrian lifestyle, ra'a, this feminine singular noun construct with the second masculine singular suffix. Your evil gets into the, you know, again, the tendency of the Assyrians to be very vicious, cruel, rapacious people who were greedy and abused people time and time again and didn't care. And then you've got the adverb tamid, which is designed
T-A-M-I-Y-D-H. Tamid.
This is designed to express continuity. And so the idea of it is continually, and that's as good as you can do with it here, because you have transgressed against all these other nations, and they've suffered under your hand. They are not going to be too upset to find out that you've been destroyed. They're not going to give one bit of care or concern that Assyria is gone. And what I'm going to do, I know we're going to stop a little early today because I want to end this up on, we need to end it up on a singular class. And I know if I start into this, I won't have enough for Wednesday. So we will just go ahead and stop there and then be ready to move on with this, or actually to wrap this up on Wednesday. So thank you, Father, for the opportunity to study these things. We pray that God, the Holy Spirit, will sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.